the fifth gateway, tame your mind. You perceive the world through an obscure window of beliefs, interpretations, and associations. The world is therefore a reflection of your mind. As your mind clears, you perceive reality simply as it is. What does your experience of life reveal about your filters of perception? Now let's turn to the fifth gateway. Tame your mind. I could have also titled this gateway Transcend Your Mind. And we're going to look at some new takes on what it means to meditate, what it does and does not do for you. But before we do, let's go through a few considerations, a few questions, a mind assessment. First, do you believe that you see reality as it is when you look around? What do you do when you have troubling thoughts, such as worries, concerns, guilt, preoccupations, or anxieties? What do you do? Do you believe your life would be better if you had better control over your thoughts? Have you tried to quiet your mind? What happened? Do you try to think positively? Have you successfully done so with any consistency? Should people be held responsible for petty, jealous, negative, lustful, or sadistic thoughts or ideas? Would you like to live a more simple life? What might this have to do with your mind? Let's talk about the problem of mind, how mind works. Let's underscore this. Most of you are familiar, if you've read Way of the Peaceful Warrior, or you might have even gone to the source and read Plato's Republic, or wherever that was. I remember reading the Allegory of the Cave, which describes people sitting in a dark cave with a single fire, and their shadows are projected onto the wall, and they see their shadows dancing on the wall, and to them, that's life. They look at the shadows and see, this is life. This is reality. And then by one day, somebody stumbles out of the cave, to make this story short, by accident, and walks out into the sunlight. And after being blinded by the light for a while, this person looks around and sees an entirely different reality. And they go back. The metaphor, of course, is an enlightened being. They go back and they say, wait, turn away. This isn't reality. And people say, are you crazy? What are you talking about outside? There's no outside. What is colors? What does that mean, colors? And they thought he was crazy, and until finally a few people would take a risk and start to study and listen and eventually see the sunlight. So do we see? The point is, do we see reality as it is? I suggest not. I suggest that we look through not only our eyes, and we perceive the world through a layer, like a window, a muddy window, a distorted glass. We see through our opinions, our values, our associations, our interpretations, our beliefs. We're looking through all those things. So when I looked at those women, young women getting into a Mercedes sports car, I didn't see it as it was. I saw it through my interpretation. Look at those little rich girls. Maybe they were poor actors doing a scene. I didn't know. We don't see the world as it is. We see and we hear. We perceive through filters. There are many odors in the world, and some of them we say, that's a nice odor. Ooh, that's a terrible odor. Our dog might disagree with us. Everything is just interesting to dogs, if it's an odor, right? Some odors are more fascinating than others. Point is, we make judgments about everything, and this is good, this is bad, this is spiritual, this is not. We don't see reality as it is. Let me give an example. There are many people who teach relationship trainings and communication trainings, how to communicate better. Well, this gives you a handle on understanding where people are coming from and teaches us to really listen, kind of transcend the mind while we're perceiving things. The example I give in Everyday Enlightenment, for example, a mother comes home from work. And she's feeling a little bit guilty, subtle, you know, but she's come home. Her son is already home. He's a latchkey kid. He has to let himself into an empty house. And he goes inside and he wants to space out. He just got home from school. So he turns on the television set. And he's watching a program when his mother comes in and she wants to show him that she's interested. She just got home from work and she's tired. But she says, Jack, you have much homework? What homework do you have today? Well, Jack turns to her and says, get off my back, Mom. I'll do it as soon as I can. Now, what went on there? What went on there? She just said, hi, honey. What homework do you have today? What Jack heard, however, through his filter was, hey, lazy bun, get off the couch, turn off the TV, and get to your homework. Because he was aware maybe he should be doing his homework. So he was hearing not what she said. He was not in touch with that. He was hearing his interpretation of what she said. How many of you have gone into that? How many of us have fallen into that trap? When you listen to couples communicate, it's fascinating. One will answer something that had nothing to do with a question or statement. That's how communications go awry because of this thing called mind. Beliefs impact our reality tremendously. I'll give you an example. I mentioned the word ocean cruise. What comes to mind? Well, some people, immediately the picture is ocean cruise. They picture fresh sea air, blue skies maybe. They picture ice sculptures and great food, you know, in great abundance. Those cruises have it. Maybe a swimming pool on the deck or a shuffleboard. They're picturing all these things. But I'll tell you, there are just as many people. You say ocean cruise, the first thing that comes to mind, the Titanic. You mentioned camping trip. For me, oh yeah. Cold nights, warm sleeping bag, looking up at the stars, campfire at night, panoramic vistas, walking through the trails. Yeah, but I'll tell you, I know somebody really well. I won't mention her name right now, but I say camping trip, the first thing that comes to mind, ticks, bugs, snakes, raccoons, grizzly bears, etc., and dirt, and outdoor latrines. Our beliefs and our perceptions, our expectations, when you hear these words, will tend to determine our behaviors. Some people want to go on cruises, others don't. Some like to go camping, others don't, based on their interpretations of what that means. Same experience. So our beliefs do affect, they do influence our lives and our choices, the choices we make. There are two kinds of beliefs. Only two kinds of beliefs. Conscious beliefs and unconscious beliefs. And simply put, a conscious belief is something we know is a belief. It could be a religious belief. It could be a belief in a style of dance or martial art that we practice. It could be a belief about money, about religion, about spirituality, about men or women. But we know it's a belief. It's conscious. We go, well, this is true for me. It may not be true for you, but it's true for me. This is my belief, my opinion about this. The second kind of belief is an unconscious belief. What makes it unconscious? We mistake it for truth, with a capital T. We don't say, this is my belief. We say, this is what's true. Do you get the difference? This is a source of fundamentalism. And I don't just mean religious fundamentalism. I mean cooking school fundamentalism, sports fundamentalism, English teaching fundamentalism. Anybody who says, this is the way to do it, and any other way is misguided or wrong. Conscious beliefs and unconscious beliefs. This is an email I received about a year ago. Hi, Dan. I was at your seminar in Scottsdale. I was there with my husband and four friends. You may have noticed that six people got up and left after you had been speaking for about 20 minutes. I wanted to let you know why, if you were interested. We had free tickets to this event. Bad sign right there. But none of us knew very much about you. We were not aware that you teach that, quote, sin is geographical, unquote. Actually, I was quoting Bertrand Russell. I was giving a talk on spiritual laws, how they're universally applied across every domain to every culture, but human laws and ideas of morality change from time to time, different eras and different countries. And I quoted George Bernard Shaw, who said sin is geographical. I thought it was a cute quote. But they were assuming I was teaching that, among other things. All of us there are Christians and believe that sin is definitely not geographical. Sin is sin, and it's as simple as that. You can discover this for yourself if you would read the Bible. It was very obvious that most of the people there that night were very hungry for some answers. I am saddened that they are being so completely misled. The only way to salvation is through Jesus Christ. I suggest that you read the book entitled More Than a Carpenter. This book clears up any doubt that Jesus is indeed the Son of God. I didn't know I had been denying that, but I hope that you can find some answers in the Word. I wish I could have spoken with you personally that night. I want you to know that you are in my prayers, and I hope that you will come to know the Lord Jesus as I know him and ask him into your life. He wants so much for you to invite him into your life. This was a very sincere, good-hearted person, obviously. I wrote her back and thanked her for writing me that, and also that she would be in my prayers too. And I meant it quite sincerely. By the way, she might be right. You know, she might be right. The point is, she had a very clear view and measured everything against that view. And she missed a pretty good lecture that would have maybe built some bridges for her if she'd stayed. But they heard something that plugged them in, boom, and left. That's the fundamentalism. That's unconscious beliefs. And I've received many, many letters from people who were fundamentalists, raised in fundamentalist environments, and later on they realized that there is spirit all around us, and there are many different paths to spirit. But they had to be deprogrammed, in a sense, of what they'd been drummed into them. And they realized that their beliefs were right for them, but not right for everyone else. So these are some of the problems of mind, beliefs, interpretations, and filters that we look and hear through. When someone says something to you, when your spouse, you go home, your spouse or partner says something to you, or a teacher or a boss, listen carefully to what they're saying, to what they mean, not what you mean about what they said. A very interesting exercise, you can do it on your own with a spouse or partner. You look at them, you sit facing them very closely, and you observe one another's face. And you practice speaking objectively, not subjectively, like what their face means to you, but you speak objectively, describing their face. So if you said, you're very handsome or interesting looking, that's subjective. That's your interpretation. But what you practice doing is you describe their face as you see it. One eyebrow is slightly higher than the other. They're very bushy. The nose is this way, and the eyes are this way, and there's a sheen from the forehead, and there's a heavy beard. Objectively. And it's so easy to slip into subjective interpretations. Oh, and it looks so cute, or whatever. And you learn to speak and listen very carefully. Another exercise in objective listening is to repeat what someone says to you. Repeat it back to them, which many therapists do, for example, so you know if they heard you right or if you heard them right. Did you say this? They may go, no, no, I didn't say that. I said this. And you start to improve your communication skills. These are basic things. Learning to see objectively, describe objectively, and listen objectively. It can help tremendously in relationships. And people start feeling heard, rather than off somewhere. In fact, Jean Kerr once said, I tried communicating with you, but you were so absorbed communicating with yourself, the line was busy. You may relate to that? Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, see, this is not a spiritual master, this is a president. But he said, we are not prisoners of fate, but only prisoners of our own mind. Julius Caesar suggested, as a rule, what is out of sight disturbs people's minds more seriously than what they can see. My favorite, though, is Mark Twain, who said, I've had a great many troubles in my life, most of which never happened. You see, there are two realities, two worlds we live in. Subjective and objective. Objective, to some extent, is what's around us. What's happening, what is, what's arising. And the other reality is our subjective reality, what we think and interpret about that. Life gets a lot simpler when you just accept realities that unfolds rather than, it should be this way, it should be that way, why is this, why is that? And that's what the mind tends to do. It gets in the way. What do we do about it? Speaking of interpretations of reality, do you know the story about Mullah Nasruddin? He was a Sufi wise man, kind of an enlightened idiot. Best way I can describe him. A real character. And one day Nasruddin was walking into the marketplace, and two men were shaking their fists at each other, arguing. And there was a crowd gathering around them, all this hubbub, and someone said, oh, there's Mullah Nasruddin. He'll know what to do. He'll know who's right. So Nasruddin walked up and said to the first man, well, what's your story? And the first man told his side of the story. And Nasruddin said, you're right. And the second man said, wait a minute, you haven't heard my side yet. And he told his side of the story, and Nasruddin said, you're right. And a bystander said, Mullah, they can't both be right here. And he scratched his head and said, you're right. We're all right. Everybody's right from their own viewpoint, their own interpretations of life. There's a link between the mind and the emotions. Many emotional upsets begin in the mind when the mind resists what is. That's when stress happens. You want to know a good definition of stress? Stress happens when the mind resists what is. No resistance, no stress. When you can learn to say, yes, you know, everything that happens. In my other book, The Laws of Spirit, the law of surrender, the law of acceptance is called the first law of spirit. Whatever happens, you go to a restaurant, you order something you really wanted, and they go, we're out. And you go, oh, well, that's okay, because I really wanted this. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker that said, if you don't like the way I drive, get off the sidewalk? Some people, they're standing there, a car comes at them on the sidewalk, and the first thing they see, the car, they go, you shouldn't be on the sidewalk, boom, and they get hit. Somebody else, they just jump out of the way and go, whoa, thanks, I had a chance to test my reflexes, thanks a lot. That's the law of surrender. You make use of whatever happens. You've heard it all, you know, get lemons, make lemonade, right? Most of the time we get upset, we're resisting something. Let's say you're in line at the bank. You've waited a long time. It's Friday afternoon. It's almost closed. You've been waiting for 20 minutes. And you have a little toddler with you. You're holding their hand. And you just get up to the front of the line when somebody walks right in the door, looks around the long line, steps right in front of you and says, I'm in a hurry. What are you probably going to feel? Probably a little bit put off. Why would you be angry? Because they shouldn't do that, right? There's that, I mean, is the baby next to you going to be upset? No, probably not, because they haven't learned the rules yet. They haven't supposed to wait, you're supposed to butt in line, you're supposed to wait your turn. They haven't learned all the subtext, like, why do they pick me to butt in front of? Do I look like a wimp or what? And all those things that come up in our minds at play and play and play. Instead of the objective thing, if somebody walked up, said something, stepped in here, and it took you another 35 seconds to get to the teller. The upset came because of the belief. So you can choose what you're going to do in the situation. The point is, you're not just sitting there mumbling yourself, muttering, you know, they shouldn't be doing that. You just respond to the situation naturally, but not through all these shoulds and oughts. So let's talk about liberating attention at the source of the mind. The classic method for liberating attention and getting to know the mind and transcend it is meditation. Meditation can be done many different ways. Sitting up, standing up, lying down, moving, still. Many different meditation practices. It doesn't have to be the classic sitting where you sit in a full lotus. I know people who say they can't meditate because they can't sit in a full lotus. You don't need to. You just need to sit in a stable position. You can be on a chair. It looks cool to be in a full lotus, I have to admit. It looks very cool. But that's flexibility, and that's people who are trained from youth, you know, certain legs to do that. You can sit on a regular chair with your back straight in a balanced position, neither leaning forward into the future nor backward into the past, but here and now, sitting calmly. When you do that, when you close your eyes or even keep your eyes half open and look down at the floor, different meditation methods do different styles, different postures. Some have the eyes open, some have the eyes closed. Point is, when you do that, you're no longer distracted by whatever you're doing. Washing dishes, walking. You're sitting, there's nothing else to do but start to become aware of thoughts and feelings flowing through your psyche. So you start to notice thoughts. How many of us have tried meditation once or twice or three times or for a week, but we gave it up because we thought we were supposed to sit down and quiet our mind? Right? And we said, I'm not very good at this. It's getting noisier. I can't quiet my mind, right? Well, that's not what meditation is about. It's not about quieting the mind. Great misunderstandings. When you sit down, you start noticing thoughts. And what you're doing is you're practicing enlightenment. You're practicing enlightenment, at least sitting enlightenment. Someone once asked a Zen master, what is enlightenment? He said, just sitting. Because what you're practicing is non-reactivity. You get an angry thought. You have a picture you're making of this person and what happened earlier in the day, and you just sit and breathe and let the thought go on, and then you just sit. And then a sad thought comes up, and you just sit and notice the thought and go on. You begin to see the mind for what it is. And you know what? It doesn't take that long to see the mind for what it is. Someone came up to me self-righteously once and said, "I've been meditating 35 years. And I said, "Gee, you're kind of slow, aren't you?" The reason I said that was just for fun. However, there's a truth to that, because how long does it take to see the mind for what it is? It's like reading the newspaper every day. You go, "Oh, more news today. Somebody was killed, somebody different. Oh, and there's a crash, and there's the stock market, and there's the funnies," and somehow it all blends in together after a while. The mind is thoughts bubbling, thoughts bubbling, thoughts bubbling, 10,000 thoughts a second. Meditation is useful as a fitness exercise. We could relate this to the third gateway, energize your body. But think about it. What was fitness in the old days? It was muscles, big muscles. Charles Atlas. Back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, big muscles meant you were fit. Men were considered more fit than women because they had bigger muscles generally. Then we got smarter. Then we started, Ken Cooper and others, they said, no, aerobic capacity, not muscles, that's a more meaningful description. So we didn't throw the muscles away, still good to do strength exercises. And it is very important to do also strength, some strength exercises. But we also got into, yes, aerobic capacity. Now, as our view of fitness changed, so did our exercises. It went from doing strength exercises to doing walking, running, swimming, cardiovascular exercise to develop our aerobic capacity. And we thought, that's it. Now we really understand fitness, but we don't yet. We're going to still go deeper into the body. Fitness is going to become the ability to have balanced energies flowing through the body, relaxation and suppleness and ease, the ability to release tension and stress will have an even more profound impact on what fitness really is and longevity. So our exercises will begin to change. Instead of just running or swimming or walking or doing strength, it's going to also incorporate relaxation, stretching, more yoga, tai chi, and meditation as a fitness exercise. It does other things too. If you sit every day very quietly with a good posture and breathing, you also tend to open up channels to creativity. You open channels to the subconscious. One good way. You start getting ideas and all kinds of things come in. That's not the purpose of meditation, ultimately, but those are side benefits. You break down the wall between dreaming and waking. You start to notice things of a more subtle nature. You start to get to know the subconscious. There's a regular process I describe in another book called No Ordinary Moments. And on another Nightingale Conant program, Practical Wisdom. But that talks about process that you go deeper and deeper, conscious to the subconscious, to a quiet space. It's only quiet, not because the thoughts stop, but because your attention goes somewhere else. And that brings us to a very important point. Meditation isn't the one answer to life, it's simply a useful exercise. We put it up on a pedestal, like it's the one holy exercise that's going to the answers to everything. But I know a lot of friends who meditate a great deal and they're broke, their money issues are just all over the place. They go, "Oh, car broke, I better meditate some more." So it's not enough. It's one aspect of life. It's a useful practice. In fact, the primary benefit of meditation, and it's not discussed too much, is as a practice of enlightenment. When you can do it sitting, you can learn to do it walking around and moving. In order to convey this, I need to express something that's kind of difficult to express. There are two levels of reality, the conventional level and the transcendental level. Now, let me draw a metaphor. Isn't it true that spiders are bloodthirsty, vicious, merciless killers from the viewpoint of a fly? From our viewpoint, they might be lovely, aesthetic, fascinating creatures and relatively harmless for the most part. So both those things are true. Spiders are killers, merciless. From a fly viewpoint, from ours, a different truth operates. In the same way, there are conventional truths that are true. For example, who would deny someone who's lost a loved one, a child or a loved one, a spouse, they've died, that death is tragic, is sad, is painful. Nobody would deny that who has experienced it, someone close to you. Yet from a transcendental viewpoint, death is an illusion. Complete illusion. Doesn't exist. Everybody who's had an illumination, insight, a vision, they go, death is, what is it? It's just a change. Both are true, but it depends on what level you're looking at. The reason I mention this is because there are transcendental truths, and when you sit down to meditate, you take a look at this truth, we are one. Are we one? You've heard this, right? We are all one. One family, one body, one consciousness. Well, I'll tell you, if I stub my toe, does it hurt you? I don't think so. So physically we're not one. If I have a certain emotion, do you have the same one necessarily? No. How about if I have a thought? Do you have the same thought? I doubt it. So physically, mentally, emotionally, we're not one. We're separate. We're separate. So what is this saying, we are one? Maybe that's a transcendental truth. Maybe when you sit down to meditate, what are you doing? You're watching your thoughts. You're watching your body. Aches and pains, imbalances. You're watching your thoughts. You're watching your emotions. You're not your emotions. You're not your thoughts. You're just watching them. You may watch your soul. You may watch your higher self at times. What you become is pure awareness. Is it possible, sitting here together, is it possible in this moment we are exactly the same awareness shining through all these different eyes? The same consciousness we sometimes call God. Wow. That's why meditation is useful, because you get to practice becoming pure awareness and transcending the world. That is the primary use of meditation, not just getting more creative or watching your thoughts or trying to quiet your mind. In fact, you can't quiet the mind. The mind's always bubbling. Let's get a little more controversial now, okay? When I suggest to you, you have absolutely no control over your thoughts. No control over your thoughts. Therefore, didn't we already agree you have no responsibility for what you can't control? Therefore, you have no responsibility for any negative, petty, jealous, nasty thoughts you ever think again. But you may disagree. You may say, no, wait a minute, Dan, I can control my thoughts. I've snapped out of it. I've had bad thoughts and stopped having them. Well, let me suggest that thoughts come up and thoughts go. You can influence your thoughts by changing your environment, by distracting yourself, by even making a different picture in your mind. You can make an apple right in your mind, but can you directly control your thoughts, the thoughts that come into your mind and leave? Do you think a thought before you think it? Do you say, I think I'll think this thought next? I don't think so. If you're obsessed about something, and we've all been obsessed about things, really worried, really concerned, you know, can't stop thinking about it, can you go, okay, I'm just going to stop thinking about that now? Maybe you can distract yourself, but it comes back, doesn't it? Think about it. I'm not asking you to agree, but consider that you have virtually no control by willing a thought to change. For example, please, for a moment, control your mind. Do not think of elephants. Okay? Don't think of elephants now. Don't. You see, even if you were able to make a picture of an apple, I'll bet an elephant entered in there somewhere. We have much less control. You may disagree. You may think I have some control of my thoughts. Have you read books on positive thinking? Well, raise your hand if you've only had positive thoughts for the last week. I rest my case. It's one of those illusions. We think we can work on our mind and fix our mind. Lots of books will tell you how to think positively and fix your mind. Then your life can change. But if you may be waiting a long time to fix your mind. And you can affirm this and you can visualize that. Oh, some of these are ways to influence the mind by visualizing positive outcomes. And that can help, because your subconscious doesn't know the difference between what you're actually visualizing or what you see with your physical eyes. So it can kind of set the stage for a change in your life. There's that. But you have no control over your thoughts. Now, this is important to consider, for reasons we'll get into in a little while. Consider that. When you meditate, are you trying to control your mind? No. What you're doing is, to some degree, you can control your attention. Let's say you're walking through a park one day and you're really worried about something. You're worried about something. What does that mean? Where is your attention? When you're worried, your attention is making pictures in your mind, right? It's on your thoughts. Oh, what am I going to do about this? Then maybe a frisbee comes your way. Maybe Ron Kaufman is around and he threw a frisbee toward you. And you reach out and grab it. In that moment, you weren't worrying, were you? Your attention shifted to the frisbee to catch it. Of course, if you're a little neurotic, you might hold the frisbee saying, I wonder if I should have caught this. But that's a different story. And then later, you give them back the frisbee and you walk along and there's that worry again. We can shift our attention from our worry to doing the dishes, to walking, and so on. We have some control, not very good control. And in fact, let me give you an example. Let's say I'm holding up a book. Keep your eyes on the book. Or wherever you are right now, if you're listening to this tape program, focus your eyes on an object in front of you. While you're doing that, keep all thoughts out of your mind and all feelings, no emotions. Just focus your eyes on the book or whatever object you're looking at as you listen to the program. Now, I'm going to ask you to do some things while you're focusing on that object. I'd like you to feel really, really happy right now. Now feel really afraid. Now feel very sad. Now feel surprised. Remember, no thoughts meanwhile. All right, it doesn't take too long to make this basic point. And let me ask you simply this. Did you have more control over keeping your eyes fixed on that object, which is a physical behavior? Didn't you have more success with that than feeling whatever I asked you to feel or keeping all thoughts out of your mind? We learned we can control our behavior. You were able to probably keep your eyes fixed on that object. But control the thoughts? I don't think so. The highest meditation then, and this is not what you will read in many books or hear under the programs. The highest meditation has nothing to do with fixing the mind. Socrates once told me, Dan, the mind's like a barking dog. You don't have to get rid of the dog. After all, dogs bark. It's what they do. Just don't pay attention to it. Let it do its thing and get on with your life. The highest meditation, the highest way to tame or transcend the mind, is to allow the mind to have any thoughts it wants. Thoughts come, thoughts go. Sometimes they're positive, sometimes they're negative. Sometimes they're petty, jealous, nasty, whatever. And that's natural. They just bubble up. We don't know why we think a thought. Sometimes it's something in our environment, something that just happened, the food we ate that day, or combinations thereof. You no longer have to be an adversary of the mind or afraid of the mind. A nun once came to my martial arts training. She had written me before she came. She had been haunted most of her life, agonized by guilt over the petty, erotic, lustful, negative, jealous thoughts she had had. She came to understand that she cannot control her thoughts. She has no direct control over them. She can desperately try to shift her attention elsewhere, but what happens when you try not to think about something? Don't ever not try to think about something, because you can obsess on it then. It's natural that someone who is in a tradition where they're not supposed to have erotic, lustful thoughts is going to have a lot of lustful, erotic thoughts. She felt tremendous freeing up of her life, realizing that she was not responsible for her thoughts, despite some teachings to the contrary. Just consider it. You don't have to believe it or agree with it. Start to notice in your life whether you can actually control your thoughts and make them positive. And if you realize, I have very little control. My thoughts just, they're there and they're gone. They do pass away. They come and they go. You don't have responsibility for them. So don't worry about it. Mind's no longer a problem. Let thoughts come. Listen objectively. Pay attention. And get on with your life. That's how you tame your mind. Not by working on affirming this and visualizing that and trying to fix the mind. I'd like you to take, if you can, in your situation right now, I'd like you to take 1 minute to do a 1 minute meditation. People ask me if I meditate every day. I say, absolutely, I meditate every single day for 30 seconds to a minute. Many people say you have to meditate 20 minutes or a half an hour. And I say, well, that's very nice, but many people who start that end up not having time to do it. Like the workout, like exercise. If you do a workout every day, before you get out of bed, just sit for 30 seconds and you can meditate every day the rest of your life. I'd like you to sit comfortably with your back straight, not leaning back in your chair, but sitting straight up, chin tucked in, back of the head pulled up by a string, hands folded in your lap, tongue in the roof of the mouth, shoulders relaxed, not leaning forward into the future, not leaning backward into the past, but sitting right here in the present. Breathing naturally in the belly, and for a moment practice your enlightenment. Become awareness itself. Be aware of whatever is arising, aware of my voice, aware of background noises, resisting nothing, aware of your breathing, aware of your body, aware of any thoughts that come, any emotions, as the most natural thing in the world. For a moment, celebrate who you truly are, which is pure, pure awareness itself, shining through those particular eyes. No complication about it. Not difficult. Don't need to quiet the mind. Don't need to get rid of nasty thoughts. Just sitting. Okay, whenever you're ready, you can open your eyes. Now you may go, what did I accomplish just then? Was that make-believe? Did I just sit there and do nothing? What you accomplished was, for a few moments, taking time just to be. You know, we've been called human doings rather than human beings. I don't meditate to get anywhere. I don't meditate to achieve something or reach a spiritual goal. I meditate because it's a natural, appropriate thing to do in the rhythms of our day. We have times we're sociable, we have times of quiet, we have times of activity, times of passivity. So in the rhythms of our day, doesn't it make sense to have at least a few minutes or a minute to just sit and become pure awareness and let go of the world and just watch everything without any resistance? That's a practice of everyday meditation, everyday enlightenment, one practice. But I want to give you something even more practical. And if you remember nothing about taming the mind or nothing from this entire seminar other than this, take it to heart. One of the keys, and many people have written to me saying, Dan, I read Peaceful Warrior. What I got out of it was living in the present, living in the present. Lots of people today write about, talk about living in the present moment. But how do you really do that? The paradox is you can't live anywhere but the present moment. Your body exists right now. Now some of us go, yes, but what about my mind? I even taught this in the past. It was a mistake. I taught that your mind can go to the future, your mind can go to the past. But you know, some physicists say it's all happening past and future right now anyway. So it's really a paradox. But you know what? When you have a thought of the future, you're still in the present moment. You're thinking right now about what you imagine the future to be like. The content of your thoughts is what you imagine to be the future, or what you seem to remember as the past. But you're thinking right now. Everything is now. So what does it mean, telling people to live in the present moment? You can't live anywhere but the present moment. What it's really saying, this wisdom principle, is suggesting that you keep return your attention to the present moment. Instead of letting your attention drift to thoughts, which are almost always about past or future, whenever you're troubled about something, whenever, oh, what am I going to do about? Or, how's this going to be at the dentist when I go later? It's about something past or future. There are very rarely problems in the present moment. just what Mark Twain said. Had many problems, most of which never happened. The present moment, there are very few problems. So by bringing your attention back to the present, you transcend the mind because you don't have any thoughts in the present moment. It's impossible to have a thought in the present moment. Let me say that again. You cannot have a thought in the present moment. A thought is virtually always about something that you expect is going to happen or already happened. In the present moment, moment to moment, all there is pure attention, attention, attention. You know those five rules for life? The five rules for living are: one, show up. Woody Allen said it, 99% of life is showing up. The second rule is pay attention. The third rule is live your truth. The fourth rule is do your best in the moment. And the fifth rule is don't be attached to the outcomes, because we can't predict it. So that part about paying attention in the present moment. See, there's no dogma here. This isn't the church of the peaceful warrior where you're not allowed to think about the past or future. Of course we do that. You can plan your day. Don't get attached to the plan. But you can plan your day. You can remember things. It's when you're troubled by something. So there's no church or belief system. In fact, if I ever start a church, I'm going to call it the Born Yesterday Church of Occasional Clarity. That has a certain ring to it. Today, life seems so complex. Information overload. We all want to live a simpler life. And there are techniques, you know, get rid of clutter in your house and so on and so forth. There are books on that are very good about simplifying practical things. But you know what? What really simplifies your life is simplifying your mind. Well, you just don't pay as much attention to it. Let the mind be whatever it is. Bless it. And get on with focusing on what you can control, your behavior. My life is very busy. I've been in 38 cities this year so far. I'm going to Europe in 2 weeks. Back-to-back lectures, about 8 cities in Europe. Jet lag, the whole thing, and all day-to-day media appointments. But my life, and I at home, I have the kids, and one of them starting college soon, and the other's in high school, and lots going on. But you know what? My life is very simple. Because I can only do one thing at a time. And that's all you can do too. Lao Tzu said, as soon as you have a thought, laugh at it. It has nothing to do with your life. Let it be. Just one of those symptoms of life. Dr. Frank Crane, a thought can do you more good than the doctor, banker, or faithful friend. It can also do more harm than a brick. That's if you take them too seriously and let them drive your life. Is that clear? Thoughts are not the problem. It's when you let them drive your behavior. You have an angry thought instead of, an angry thought. And then you behave kindly. Instead, you get angry. And you lash out. Let thoughts be what they are without letting them run your life. The sixth gateway. Trust your intuition. Below everyday awareness is a shaman-like, childlike consciousness. Weaver of dreams, keeper of instinct. Your subconscious holds keys to a treasure house of intuitive wisdom, clear sight, and untapped power. All you have to do is look, listen, and trust, paying attention to dreams, sensations, and instincts. If you can't trust your own inner senses, what can you trust? We're ready now to get into the sixth gateway. Trust your intuition. Do you find decisions easy to make? What about when a decision involves a major crossroads in your life? When you weigh the pros and cons of any situation, do you feel confused? Recall an important time when you trusted your intuition. Recall an important time when you didn't. Do you tend to place more faith in the guidance of experts and others than in your own instinct? If someone offers guidance that doesn't fit with your intuition, which do you trust more? If you could easily access and trust your intuitive abilities, how might this change the way you live? Some things to consider. Often we think of intuition when we're making a decision about something. In order to talk about intuition in a practical way, I want to talk for a moment about the two sides of the brain. Now, we used to be taught that our left brain was our rational, linear, logical side, and our right brain was holistic, intuitive, spatial, very different capacity, creative side. And recent research has shown it's not strictly divided along the two sides of the brain. However, the left brain still is more involved with just that, the linear, the logical, the rational, the analytical. And the right brain is more involved than the left in holistic, spatial, creative, intuitive guidance. In fact, I suggest that our subconscious delivers intuitive guidance largely through the right brain. In a sense, you could say that our left brain is science, and our right brain is mysticism. And in our society today, we are seeing the combination, the pulling together of science and mysticism, not the split between the two. At the furthest reaches of physics, it gets very mystical. And mystics are seeking to discover the same thing scientists. They're going to the same place. The same thing scientists are searching to discover the laws of the universe, mystics are also seeking to discover, just in different methods. One is primarily outward directed, using our senses to observe the world. And the other is primarily internally directed. Different methods of research. I'm a great fan of science. Science gave us the double-blind control study. Science gave us a method by which to test reality, and it pulled us out of the dark ages of superstition. So don't for a moment mistake comments I may make later on as being anti-scientific or anti-intellectual. Our intellect is one of our capacities. We should use it to the fullest. But when science becomes a religion, then faith becomes heresy. I don't know if you saw the movie Contact, a movie I enjoyed very much. And Jodie Foster, her character, Dr. Ellie Arroway, plays a scientist, a rigorous scientist. And she's asked in a Senate hearing, do you believe in God? And she's stumped. She can't answer it. She knows someone sabotaged her asking that question. Joss, who is a spiritual leader. And she said, I am a scientist. I have to go with data that I can prove. And later on, she has a conversation with Joss, who is also a love interest of hers. And he says, so you have to prove it. He said, by the way, did you love your father? She said, yes, I love my father. And he said, prove it. Makes a good point. We can't always prove everything. Science is a good way to learn about the world, but it's not the only way to know about the world. And you've grown up, again, programmed in a society. After Sputnik went up, our country was directed towards science. That very day, priorities started shifting. Science has become a religion, almost, in our society. And if someone is unscientific, if they share a mystical experience, they're looked on with amusement, benign amusement, or ridiculed. It's changing today. As we speak, it's starting to change. What I'm suggesting is there are two ways to know about the world. We need to value the left brain, but also integrate the right brain. There are ways to know about the world, move through the world, make decisions that are based on internal sensations, kinesthetic, visual sensations, and just kind of internal hits we get about something. You can analyze things to depth. How many of us have weighed pros and cons, benefits and liabilities, ins and outs, ups and downs, until our mind starts chasing its own tail, and it's the old paralysis by analysis? How many of us, have made a decision based on logic and reason? We've waited, we've drawn it out, and so on. But the next morning we wake up with a funny feeling about it. I listen to that feeling because our intuition gives us subconscious information not accessible to our logic and reason. We may not be fully aware of. So I believe in reading the labels of food cans, but also smelling it. Sensing it. How does it feel to you? That's what the intuitive capacity is. We all have it. Many times we talk about women's intuition. Why do we talk about women's intuition? Well, there's some evidence that women work a little more through the right brain. There are some excellent women mathematicians, but far more men mathematicians. In school, men seem to do better in general as a whole than women. They may be more in the left brain, where women are in the right brain. Again, that represents a coming together, because we're here to manifest our full male and female qualities. Women are here to really develop the left brain. Men are here really to develop the right brain until we're balanced. That's what it's about. All of us becoming balanced. We talk about women's intuition because women have been allowed, in a sense, to show and express feelings more. More than men. Men need to be liberated more in that area. Because if you're out of touch with your feelings, you're also somewhat out of touch with your intuition. Why would men be less reinforced for feelings? It may be even biological, genetic. I mean, in the old days when men were hunting mammoths, and I believe men probably went out in the hunts more than women. I think there's some anthropological evidence to that. When they were out hunting or in battle, did they have to be in touch with their feelings? Well, no, but they had to be in touch with their intuition to survive. But not so much in the emotional area. So when men are in touch with their feelings, when they know, yeah, I'm feeling angry, I'm sad, you know, they're also more in touch with their intuition. So it's really not women's intuition. Truly, it's human intuition. We all have a subconscious mind, a basic self, whether we call it the inner child, whatever we call it. We all have that capacity. The question is, do we trust it? Carl Jung once wrote, "The great decisions of human life have far more to do with instincts and other unconscious factors than with conscious will and well-intentioned reason. The shoe that fits one person pinches another. There is no recipe for living that suits all cases. Each of you carries your own life plan, which cannot be superseded by any other." Trusting your intuition is really about trusting yourself. Two ways of knowing about the world, what we study and what we sense. Now, how does intuition work differently, probably, in you and the person next to you or someone you know well? We have five senses in the world: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. Our intuition works much the same way. Some of us get pictures. We don't know what they mean, but we get these symbolic pictures that turn up. Colors, impressions, but they're visual. Some of us, that's how our intuition works. We get a picture. Others of us, it's more auditory. We hear a tone or a song. Or, I'll tell you something funny happened to me. I was on a radio show. Her name is Bonnie. It's called Seeing Beyond Radio in California. I was in San Francisco in the studio. And she was new at this radio station, and the computer wasn't working. And she went through half the program talking with some guy on the phone, going, "How does this thing get it to work? We're not hooked up. We're not linked up." And I started humming, and I had no idea what I was humming. I just, And it turned out I was humming "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. My Bonnie Lies Over the Sea." And again, her name was Bonnie. I had no idea why that, I hadn't hummed that tune in years. But she felt so far away at that moment. That's how impressions come, auditory impressions. It can be songs, it can be voices. Some people hear voices, it could be their own voice, or the voice of a parent or a teacher. Could be even Socrates. Point is, some of us hear voices that aren't hallucinating or schizophrenic, but it's just our way of getting the information. Some of us, though, it's not so much visual or auditory, and we get a feeling, a gut-level feeling. Kinesthetic, kind of, that feels off. My back hurts, my knee, something feels off, or good. More rarely, we get a smell, something smells rotten about this, or we get a taste, this is a sweet deal. Point is, there's also another kind of intuition which is non-localized. It's not a vision, it's not a thought, it's not a sound. It's just a non-localized knowing. Just knowing, and you don't know where it came from. Once you start to tune into that, life gets really interesting. It doesn't only help you find parking spaces, though it can work for that a lot of the time. The key to opening to your intuition is letting your mind get out of the way. It's good to think rationally, and it's good to intuit, but not at the same time. If you're trying to figure it out, your intuition's in the background. In the background. You have to start with a cosmic duh. You don't know anything. You're looking for a parking space and you go, well, I don't know. I don't know where space is. I don't know anything. If you think, well, maybe logically most people turn right, that doesn't work. You just don't know, and from there you get an impression. Check it out. See if it works. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. Again, it can be an amusing party game. The way it works is this. There's a game where I can hide a coin in one of my hands or the other. And I can hold it out to you. And if you and I practice this, you can try this with a partner. I know where the coin is, right? It's not a double blind experiment. I know where the coin is, but I'll do my best to hold my hands equally. And you look down and you don't know where it is, but you know what? Your subconscious knows where it is. Because our subconscious minds are in touch. They're connected. Let me give an example. Have you ever watched someone getting a massage? A friend, you know, just getting a back rub? It relaxes you. Have you ever walked into a room where somebody was really upset, but they weren't owning up to it? You know, their face was blank. But boy, you walk in, you can cut it with a knife. How do you know? Oh, someone might say you're picking up on subtle cues. Well, maybe. But, I mean, once in a while when I'm doing a seminar, somebody has a serious issue with me or with something I've said, and my attention goes wham, right to that person. And it keeps going, and it's like, what's going on here? How do I know? I can feel it. Our subconscious, they're all in touch. So that's one example of how intuitive capacities can work. You know, but you don't know you know, and you don't know how you know, but you know. Let me give you an example I would challenge anyone to explain away. It's a pretty silly example, and I wish I could give you a more uplifting example of intuitive capacities that we all have. But this is how it happened. I used to do life purpose readings by audio tape. Before I wrote The Life You Were Born to Live, people asked me, please do a life reading for me. So I would take a tape library, one of the 37 life paths, and I would determine that person's life path and send it off. Very accurate, as you'll find if you ever look at The Life You Were Born to Live. Scary, it's so accurate. However, I would send these tapes off, and I charged, I don't know at the time, probably $25 for them. And so I would get checks every day. In the mail, we'd open the mail, look, there's a check, please do it, send me a spiritual law life reading on audio tape. Next one, same thing. Next one, same thing. And I had about 5 letters that day, and I opened the third one or whatever, and I looked. And it was a bank check, a regular imprinted check, a signature, and it said, please send me this. This is my birth date. And I held the check, and I went, something's wrong with this check. I had never done that before, and I've never done it since. Now, we've had checks that have bounced. Somebody just screwed up their bank account. You know, that happens. But in this case, I could be remembering wrong, right? You could explain that maybe I had suspicions about lots of checks, but no. But the point is, I called the bank, and I'd never called, physically picked up the phone and called the bank to check on a check before. And I had no reason to do it. They said, oh, the number's been changed. I had to make another long-distance call, a second one. So something must have been there. They called me, and I learned that this person had closed their account 3 months before. There were no funds. They had written a bad check deliberately. I sent the check back and said, next time, please send a good check if you'd like a reading. I never heard from them again. Now, how did I do that? I don't care if you're head of the Skeptic Society. I can have no explanation. There was no way for me to know. But there are people who make a living. They're kind of psychic touch, who just touch things, hold rings, try to find bodies that are lost. All we can explain it as somehow we're interconnected. There's threads going through the universe, energy threads, invisible threads. We don't often tune into, but as your attention is free, and remember the purpose of these gateways, as your attention rises up, you start having free attention to do some interesting things. It's not all about finding bad checks. It may be about picking your path in life, about knowing which decision to make, seeing where the light is. So intuition is used for many things, including decision making. Now, I'd like you to contemplate for a moment, have you had trouble making decisions, especially if they seemed important? I want to show you a method now to make far better decisions for yourself. Make them more easily and be better informed. It's called timelining. And I'd like you to do this for a moment. I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm deciding whether to take path A or path B in life. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And I'm weighing, well, path A has this, but path B, then path B has this, but. going back and forth, the process we usually go through. Make a decision, no, I'm not so sure, I'll change my mind, and so on. Here's how you do it. You say to yourself, I've just chosen path A. That's it, I'm committed to that direction. Then you write down on a piece of paper, very briefly, you can even contemplate it, not write it down, but I like writing it down. How will I look? How will I feel, and what will I be doing 1 hour from now, having made that decision? What will I look like? What will I be, and what will I be doing, and how will I feel 1 hour from now, having made decision A? That shouldn't be too hard to do, right? You can probably guess at that pretty well. But then you write down, having chosen A, how will I feel, what will I look like, what will I be doing 1 day from now? Having made decision A. When you finish that, I'm not asking you to do this as we speak. It would take a little longer, but I want to go through the process. Then, having made decision A, what will I look like, feel like, and be doing 1 week from now? Then the same process, 1 month from now, then 1 year from now, and then 10 years from now. Now, you can't possibly know what you're going to look like, feel like, and be doing 10 years from now, can you? Having made decision A. But what you are doing is, you're accessing your imagination. And the imagination is much more than we give it credit for. We go, oh, that's just your imagination? Well, you know, when you die, you won't have a body anymore. All you'll have left is your imagination. So let me ask you, which is more real? Imagination is the beginning of clairvoyant sight. And you may say, well, maybe I just imagined this because I really wanted to do this. Great, it helps you make the decision. But why did you imagine one thing? Why did one thing come up in your imagination and not another? So you use your imagination as a tool to intuition and to make decisions. And it gives you perspective, not just what do I want to do right now, but what will be the consequences do I project in my life? An hour, a day, a month, a week, or a week, a month, a year, and 10 years from now. After you've done that, which should only take maybe 5 to 8 minutes, then you ask yourself, no, I'm not going to do a decision A. B is the one I'm going to choose. Absolutely. Why? How could I have ever chosen A? I choose B. And you go through the same process. What will I look like, feel like, and be doing 1 hour, day, week, month, year, and 10 years from now? It only takes 10 to 12 minutes to do this whole process. To me, it's worth it because it's going to give you an entirely new, intuitive sense. And you'll be much more clear on what you want to do using this method. What if you can't see anything? What if you can't imagine it? You use two magic words. What if I knew? Some people are very stubborn. They go, but I don't know. And I go, well, what if you knew? But I don't know. Yes, but what if you knew? What if your IQ went up to 10,000? What if suddenly you were clairvoyant, you turned into Edgar Cayce, you're channeling him? What if? Finally they go, well, okay, if I knew, I don't mind you, but if I knew, I might say this. Those two words can open clairvoyant sight. Clairvoyance means clear seeing. There's also clairsentience, clear feeling, clairaudience, clear hearing, different kinds of clear knowing. Now, there's an assumption that goes on that once we trust our intuition, our lives will be so easy. We'll just go there, find this parking space, make this decision, just intuit it. And it can get like that. It really can. But does it mean your life will be easy from then on? Not necessarily. You know, the saying, thy will, not my will be done, means you're also going to accept any form of calamity that may occur. You don't go, thy will be done, as long as I like it. So you can make a decision. You can say, well, I chose A. I did my timelining. I chose A. I'm going to go up path A. And trees can fall in your path and obstacles and difficulties and the rug gets pulled out from under you. Does that mean it was the wrong decision? Not necessarily. It may be exactly what you need for your highest good in learning. I knew one girl who was deciding, this isn't my daughter who's going to Stanford soon, but another girl was deciding whether to go off to Stanford University or run off to Europe with a druggy punk rock boyfriend. Her parents did express a definite opinion in the matter. And that's their job. That's their duty. But cosmically speaking, We don't know what's the best decision for our ultimate growth and good. We don't know. So, for example, in making decisions for my kids, depending on what age they are, it's my job. Those little souls were given into my care for a certain amount of time for a reason. So I will try to convince them, negotiate with them, educate them of what I think is best. It's my responsibility as a parent. But if they then, depending once they're, 17, 18, 19 and above, if they then say, I don't agree with you, this is what I need to do, then I'll be behind them all the way. I'll support them all the way and wish them well and bless them. And certainly hope it works out. At some point you respect what someone feels they need to do. What happens when we don't trust our intuition? A friend of mine studied thousands of police reports of women who are mugged in their home or apartment. I've seen a news program recently about this. Someone comes up wearing a uniform of the electric company, gas company, and they say, I wonder if I could come in, we need to check something. And at first they may go, no, I don't think so. And they go, we'll have to come back next week. But they say, oh, well, okay, come on in. They looked very official. Many times, and they were mugged or beaten or whatever. In the police reports that he read, their conscious mind said, well, it's logical. I mean, look, I don't want to be awkward here, cause a scene. He's wearing a uniform. He flashed an ID and he's got a van. And so, of course, he's probably what he says he is. But on the police reports, virtually every police report, somewhere in there, it said, but I had a bad feeling about it. But they didn't listen to the feeling. That's what happens when you don't trust your intuition. If you have a bad feeling about something, listen to that. Your subconscious is crying out, trying to tell you something. This is different from letting emotions drive your life. This feeling, we get confused with the word feeling. There are emotional feelings or impulsive feelings, or there are deep intuitive senses. I don't want to get tangled up in semantics here. There's a difference between intuition and kind of an emotional impulse. People go, well, how do I know between an impulse to do something and a deep intuition? There's a certain kind of emotional congruence and confirmation. You'll know when it's an intuition. I don't know if you wear contact lenses, but when I first got contact lenses years ago, soft lenses, I couldn't tell whether they were right side out or popped inside out. Those who wear contacts understand. I had to look and look. Well, after a little while, it was obvious. You can just see the difference. You learn to do the same thing, the difference between a mental impulse and the deep intuition of, I should be doing this or no, something's off about this. You do learn as you start to pay attention to it over time. Why should you trust your intuition? Why would your subconscious know something any better than your rational mind? Can't we trust our rational mind? Yes, to a certain degree we can. But experience should have taught you that your rational mind is not very good at making decisions because it's just so many variables to weigh. It's like trying to figure out all the nutrients in a food. There are nutrients in foods we haven't measured yet. That's why you trust your instincts, because they know what analysis of a food can't yet determine. Why should you trust it? Because the subconscious mind has powers that our conscious mind doesn't. The placebo effect. Most of us are familiar with the placebo effect, how some people seem to get better when they take a sugar tablet that has no real pharmaceutical effect. When doctors can't explain somebody's remission from a disease, they say, oh, it's the placebo effect. Let's look at this. There are many documented cases in which someone had a disease that was considered terminal or serious, and it went into remission. It got better almost miraculously, suddenly, because someone went to Lourdes in France and took the water there. In fact, I'm working on a new book with a colleague now called Divine Interventions, Stories of Sacred Magic, True Life Miracles, and Lives Transformed. And that book will be out in the fall of 1999, Divine Interventions. And I learned this, that a few people, get healed at Lourdes. But many people, if not most, don't. Some people will go to a faith healer, they go into remission. But it doesn't work for everybody. Some people start eating a pure, natural, all raw diet or fast. And they go, they're healed. It doesn't work for everybody. Some people start exercising, they sweat. They go to sweat lodges and they work out so hard that it burns the disease away. Tumors disappear. Doesn't work for most people, just for some. Some people use the power of prayer. And it works for them, but doesn't work for most people in certain cases. In other words, there are many, many things, different means, modalities, faith, science. Some people do chemotherapy and radiation. Works for some people, doesn't work for everybody in terms of 5-year survival rates. Not much better than some alternative methods. However, if your belief is in science, that's what you should do. If your belief is in acupuncture, do that. I am definitely a believer in Western medicine for their diagnostic tools. Excellent diagnostic methods. And I would go with the statistics with recognized treatments for any disease. So don't mistake me for saying, don't do radiation and chemotherapy. Just go off and, you know, use some crystals. One lady came up to me once and said, Dan, I have this crystal. I think somebody told me it's a weight loss crystal. And I went, yeah, looks like that to me. Did they tell you how it works? She said, no, not really. I said, what you do is, between meals, hold it between your teeth like this. It also works for birth control. You just put it between your knees. Point is, we don't want to go for subtle solutions to gross problems. But don't throw out the possibility of grace, of miracles either. So again, it's about the left and the right brain integrating both science and mysticism, rationality and intuition, just knowing. I was talking about the powers of the subconscious. Those people who were healed, who were cured, and there are documented evidence, there's documented evidence of it. I studied it. How did they heal? Is it possible, whatever it was, there was enough belief, enough faith there, maybe that's the variable, where they believed in Lords enough. Their body, their basic self said, yes, this is going to do it. Remember, your subconscious works through the autonomic nervous system. It's in charge of the body. It can cause or cure any disease if it's permitted under the laws of karma, let's say, to use a metaphysical image. When someone is hypnotized, a good hypnotist with a good subject can put an ice cube on their arm and say, I'm about to touch you with a lit cigarette, the person will jump and a welt will raise up. Who raised that welt? Was it their conscious mind? Can you concentrate really hard in your arm and raise a welt? I doubt it. The subconscious could do that. It can bring in states of hypermotivation and concentration where our memory improves. There's some controversy about whether it's a magical state, you know, or just a state of concentration and high motivation. Nevertheless, we can even solve problems with our subconscious. When I was coaching at Stanford, one of the gymnasts came in and said, Dan, I was in Professor Dement's, Bill Dement's, an expert on sleep and dreaming. He said, I was in Bill Dement's dreaming class, and he just gave us an interesting problem, and I just can't figure it out. It's a problem we were supposed to solve overnight in our dreams. And I said, what's the problem? He said, oh, the problem is H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O. I said, wait a minute, tell me again, what's the problem? He said, H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O. I said, well, I don't understand. He said, I don't either. But we're supposed to solve it tonight in our sleep. And they were writing down their dreams every night. Well, the next morning he came and he worked in the gym to sweep up and mop the place, part of his scholarship. And I said, Ted, do you have any dreams? He said, I didn't solve it. I don't know what happened. He said, all I dreamt about an ocean. I was in an old schooner and it was crashing in the waves and there was a storm, lightning and thunder, like one of the old movies, and water splashing everywhere and pouring down. And he said, I haven't a clue, you know. Well, he came back that afternoon after he'd gone to the class and said, I solved the riddle and I didn't know it. I said, what do you mean? He said, the riddle, H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O, are the letters H to O. H-2-O. Water. And that's all he dreamt about, it seems like, that whole night. Water. His subconscious knew the answer. His conscious mind didn't. The intuition has powers and abilities we don't often trust. But it can do things our conscious mind cannot. There are ways to access the subconscious. One, meditation. It's a good way to start opening up the subconscious. Meditation is one of the best. Another is dream yoga. Now, like many people, I really didn't remember my dreams much. I rarely remember my dreams. You may not either. Then one day I decided, I said, you know what? I better know more about my shadow. So I went to a Jungian therapist, because they work with dreams. And the first session, she, to my dismay, she said, Dan, next week when you come back, bring me your dreams. And I was going, what dreams? I can't remember my dreams. She said, just bring me your dreams. Well, I woke up every night at 4 in the morning when the Midnight Express dropped me off, or 3 in the morning. I was waking up and going, oh yeah. I was getting these impressions and starting to scribble them down. I didn't want to wake my wife. I was turning on the light to write them down. That was bothering her. So I got a little tape recorder and I was trying not to wake her. So I whispered into it for a while. I went, I was half asleep, you know. The next morning I turned the recorder on and all it said was, so I stopped doing that. So I started writing with it anyway. But I was willing to wake up and I was motivated to remember my dreams. I brought her the next week, a guy who doesn't remember his dreams, I brought back 5 single-spaced typed pages of dreams. So you'd be surprised. You can remember your dreams. If you really decide to, you can. And they're fascinating. Endless imagery and symbolism. And it's straight out of the subconscious. Now, some dreams mean you had too much pizza the night before. Ate too much ice cream, whatever. Some dreams are insignificant. They're a result of physiological things and so on. But other dreams, especially when you can't make hide or hair, they're really symbolic, can be the most interesting. And they're sides of your character. We'll go into that a little more when we talk about illuminating your shadow tomorrow. But in the meantime, the subconscious can give you many, many images. What dream yoga is, the Tibetans have a way of working the bardo, the space between lives. That's what they call it. The space between lives. And they do it in the dream state. They become conscious of their dreams. Today we call it lucid dreaming. Stephen LaBerge, also at Stanford, wrote a book called Lucid Dreaming. And what they do is, you remember to look at your hand in a dream. You keep reminding yourself, every time you're dreaming, you look at your hand. And that can wake you up to lucid dreaming, where you realize you're dreaming, but you're still asleep. Does that make any sense? You're in the dream, but instead of dreaming it, you know you're asleep and dreaming. So if you see a monster, it's not so terrifying, it's there, but you have a choice what to do, because you're awake, you realize this is a dream. That's what lucid dreaming is. Some people are lucid dreamers, so they have a certain percentage. Others of us just dream unconsciously, it seems real, then we wake up. How do you know this isn't a dream right now? Didn't you have to think about it for a moment? There's a certain quality now. You ask yourself, am I dreaming? One way you can lucid dream and practice this dream yoga is to ask yourself at random points during the day, am I dreaming? Am I dreaming? And check it out. No, I think I'm awake. There's a different quality about dreams and waking reality. When you do that, you also form the habit while you're dreaming of going, am I dreaming? And then you'll realize, yes, I am. That's very exciting, especially when you start flying. That's what dream yoga is. It's becoming conscious during your dreams, which helps you to become conscious in that space after death, before birth, according to the Tibetans. You can also access the subconscious through breath work, specifically holotropic breath work. Stanislav Grof and his wife Christina, he's a psychiatrist, she is too, I believe, did LSD studies. When LSD was still legal, they did a great number of studies of the psyche and psychotic states through LSD. But then it became illegal for various reasons, and they said, we have to do something that's legal. And they started learning about breathing techniques in India. Basically, holotropic breath work is conscious hyperventilation, like for 2 hours. And what happens is, you go into this hyperoxygenated state where your conscious mind goes bye-bye. And your subconscious steps to the forefront. And they play music, loud music, ancient drums. You go into these primal states. It's another way to access the power of the subconscious. This is only tangential to your intuition, but it's relevant. Chanting and drumming and trance dancing. Drugs will work too. LSD will work. But there are certain pros and cons to any drugs. Other than being illegal, there may be some cons as well to taking drugs. So I don't recommend it. But it is one method that has been used in a sacred context in many shamanic cultures. However, trance dancing, when you just dance to music, even blindfolded, drumming, chanting like mantras over and over, ritual activities, can put you in a trance. Many swimmers experience it, long-distance swimmers or runners. All these things bring the subconscious to the fore. You start getting impressions from your past, people whose faces you haven't seen in years and years, coming out of the subconscious. And there's a utility in this. The problem with psychotics is that becomes reality to them. It controls them. They don't manage it by recognizing what it is. But when we consciously work with the subconscious and our intuition, we can start to feel life and move through life in a different way. The way animals do, with instinct. The way martial artists do. Any good police officer who's a detective uses intuition. Any good auto mechanic uses intuition. The more you know about a topic, the better your intuition will be, the better informed it will be. If you ever want to do past life readings, study history. I need to tell you about the oracle effect. You've heard of oracles? Oracles were the ancient seers, and they could bring information from the gods down and convey it to people. We call them maybe channels today. They were seers. There are also things called oracles that aren't people, but things, crystal balls. It's called scrying. Scrying, looking in a crystal ball to determine information. Reading tea leaves. The I Ching, the Chinese Book of Changes, which you throw coins down and you find the right page, you ask it a question and it gives you a general answer of wisdom. This is the oracle effect. You know about the Rorschach ink blot? In psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, it's used as a diagnostic tool. You're shown an ink blot, you know, some ink, and you look at it, and it's symmetrical, and it doesn't look like anything except to you. You look at it and go, that looks like two people making love. And they show you another ink blot, and you go, that's two animals making love. And they show you another one, and you go, oh, this is a person and an animal, never mind. The point is, they go, oh, you're obsessed with sex, and they go, you go, no, you're the one showing me all the dirty pictures. The point I'm making is, the Rorschach looks like nothing, but we project our own subconscious meaning on it. It's a diagnostic tool, but that's how crystal ball gazing works. There's nothing in the crystal ball. So what you see is your own subconscious. You access your subconscious wisdom and messages through that. The tea leaves are just a random scattering of leaves. But in that, you read it. You can look at clouds. The I Ching doesn't say anything specific. The wisdom of waiting. The clouds always stop over the open pond, whatever. But you read into that the meaning as it applies to your situation. So it accesses your own intuition. These are good ways. Oracles are good tools. Astrology is an oracle. The Tarot is an oracle, an ancient book, a holy book, in which we read meaning by different symbols. The runes, the ancient Viking, the Nordic runes, these stones with different symbols on them that mean things, all these are oracular tools. You can use these to draw out your own intuition. But the point I want to emphasize, as useful as they can be, they're training wheels. They're only training wheels or crutches for your own powers. You can know instantly without using any of those things. You are an oracle. You may not have fully discovered it yet, but when you start to trust your intuition, life changes. And again, to close off the section on trusting your intuition, remember where faith comes in. Faith is the intuition that everything that happens and any decision you make is for your highest good and learning. Whether you like it or not, whether it's easy or difficult, it's for your highest good and learning. So you need faith when you make intuitive decisions. Not that, oh good, if I trust my intuition, it'll work out great for me. It may give you new challenges that will develop you in ways you couldn't have guessed.